You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 13th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at Yale University, Samuel Moyne, on his recent book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Also on the program today, in the wake President Biden's mandate announcement, U.S. has fallen to the lowest vaccine rate of the world's wealthiest democracies. Also on the program today, unvaccinated Americans are 11 times more likely to die of COVID, 4.5 times more likely to get infected. FDA warns parents of children under 12, hold off on the vaccine until we find that it's safe for kids under 12. Meanwhile, government funding supposedly runs out in 17 days as the debt limit nears. And on that budget resolution, House Democrats are eyeing a 5.5% corporate tax rise. Bumps for those of you who make over $5 million a year in income, sorry, and a capital gains increase. Biden supposedly planning a lobbying blitz for filibuster reform and voting reform. New York Times report that drone strike, which killed 10 civilians, 7 of whom were children, may have been launched on an aid worker. California recall is tomorrow. Polling looks good to avoid the governorship of a right-wing reactionary radio host. Lastly, a federal judge ruling looks like it's going to cut deep into Apple's App Store monopoly. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. Returning to her perch at the Majority Report after a tremendously refreshing week off. Emma Figlin. Hello, Emma. I don't know why you rolled your eyes.
I go into a week off thinking it's going to be tremendously refreshing, and it's just not. Tried to train back from where I was last night. Delays. It was about 2.5 hours or times the length it normally would be. Lots of hiccups and just, you know, I'm here to complain.
That's all right. You know, I feel like during the pandemic, it has been everything's been harder.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is like just a baseline of like, a baseline of 15% to 20% more aggravating or difficult. And it goes up depending on, like, you know, it gets like exponential when you have kids, you know, when you have sort of work, complications.
And when you're a New York Giants fan, right? The kind of those things.
Or when you're a Giants fan, I guess. Yeah.
Heighten, you know. Right. I don't normally sit in the dark after my sports teams lose. It's just the pandemic.
Well, I don't know about whether that's true or not, but my guess is it's not.
It's not.
Meanwhile, the Senate is back, I believe, today. The House is coming back shortly. I mean, the House has been working. You have the committees have been working on on developing the $3.5 trillion, at least as far as we know, $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. There is a, and Joe Manchin, as we announced last week, had claimed, I just can't see us doing a $3.5 trillion bill. Maybe a $1 trillion, maybe a $1.5 trillion bill. And ostensibly, the reason why he says this is because that seems to be about it. Then there's like a mumbling about inflation, and that's about it. And so he, you know, is sort of basking in the attention, hit the Sunday morning talk shows yesterday. Here he is. Here is Joe Manchin on CNN yesterday, CNN State of the Union with Dana Bash, trying to get a sense from Joe Manchin. Okay, what is it like? What's
your reasoning?
Right, exactly. 1.5. Yeah. Well, and frankly, there's a question I wish she would have asked after this, but she didn't. But here it is. Here is Joe Manchin with his very obvious reason for saying that it shouldn't be $3.5 trillion, it should be $1.5 trillion.
I want to ask you about a lot of that, but are you saying it's the price tag, it's the timeline, both?
It's the urgency. Do we have the urgency to do what they're wanting to do in such a quick period of time?
But can you be specific? Okay, let's talk about the dollar sign.
Yeah.
Do you have a specific number in mind?
Here's a number you should be getting to. First of all, I have agreed to get on to the reconciliation because that's the time for us to make financial adjustments mm-hmm. and changes. I thought the 2017 tax code and tax law, the way it was changed, was very, very, very unfair, and it was weighted to the wealthy.
So what's the number?
And the bottom line is what the number would be, what's going to be competitive in our tax code. I believe that the corporate rate should be at 25, not 21.
But what's the overall number for the budget bill?
I think that you're going to have to look at it and find out what you're able to do through a reasonable, responsible way.
So then how do you know that it's not 3.5?
It's going to be at 1.5. We don't know where it's going to be.
So you think ballpark 1.5?
It's not going to be at 3.5, I can assure you. But with that, whatever it is, once you have a competitive tax code that you can compete globally, and then you should look at what the need is. What's the urgency and the need that we have?
And I want to get to that, but just because this is the thing that people consume. Do you have a ceiling?
My ceiling is this: the need of the American people, and for us to basically take in consideration inflation. Mm-hmm. No one's concerning about the debt. You know, our debt as of Friday was $28.75 trillion. And we're not even talking about that. No one's talking.
So you just said 1.5. It sounds like 1.5.
I'm just saying that basically, well, I've looked at numbers. If we have a competitive tax code from a non-competitive, it doesn't help the working person. It was done in 2017. That's in the 1.5 range. Okay, if that's where it is, shouldn't you be looking at what does it take now to meet the urgent needs that we haven't already met?
Okay.
How do you go into that interview and not have an answer to, like, not know that's exactly what you're going to be asked?
And frankly, I would have liked Dana Bash to say, okay, wait a second. So you're saying that there's $3.5 trillion is not made up. I mean, I don't understand really the competitive tax code stuff when he's talking about individual taxes, unless people making more than $400,000 who get taxed are going to move out of the country. I don't exactly understand what he's even saying there. But then he's saying, which I think is a rational thing, like, I want to make sure that we have an urgent need for those things that are in the bill and that they're actually needs of the American public. That's not an unreasonable thing to say. And the argument with the people who said $6 trillion was that we had $6 trillion worth of needs for the American public that were urgent. Things like climate change, things about infrastructure, things about helping people who don't have health insurance and need an expansive health insurance. And he's arguing, and then it got pushed down to $3.5 trillion. He's saying, no way, $3.5 trillion, $1 to $1.5 trillion. Now, look, you know, we sit here with $3.5 trillion. I can't tell you exactly, like, why it should be $3.5 trillion as opposed to $4 trillion, right? These are just numbers. I can't even contemplate. Like, I can't say I think we do need to expand Medicaid care, and we need to drop the, who's eligible for it. And I can go on and talk about these things that we need. Dana Bash should have asked him, what in the $3.5 trillion package do you think is not urgent or is not a need for the American public? You've just wiped out over two-thirds of it, of the bill. What are those things? Can you name me three things in there, three big-ticket items that you think just simply the American public does not need at this point? That's the question that's got to be asked to him, because it all just gets thrown around with these sort of abstract numbers, and it means nothing to anybody. And he's able to go just like, well, you say three, I say one. You know, maybe we meet two. Well, but then he's justifying this position based upon what ostensibly is very tangible and concrete things. American public doesn't need that. Well, what is that? Tell us exactly what it is that you would cut out of this bill.
Well, she's trying to pin him down for a specific number so that she can go back and hold him to that, I guess. And she doesn't have a specific value.
Because they don't even care what the...
Right,
what
but
the
she is. Doesn't care. She's not going to make a value judgment about what is needed in the reconciliation package in infrastructure. So that's why she can't ask that line of question. It's just like not
right.
in her nature. Another thing she could have asked, though, too, is why did you support $4 trillion earlier this year and think that there was an urgent need, which he was on the record saying, and now suddenly it can't be $3.5 trillion, which is beneath your initial statements on this matter. That's another way to talk about how his concept of what is urgent is quite fluid and just basically is below what the Biden administration and the Democratic Party consensus want.
I just want to know that when he gets, it's going to ultimately, he's going to be able to lower the amount of the package mm-hmm. by how much, we don't know. But I just like wonder what it is that he thinks he's going to be able to go back to West Virginia and go like, I killed the blankety blank initiative.
I'd imagine it's the climate provisions.
Very possibly, but those provisions are basically going to pay for coal miners to find other work. But we shall see. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Samuel Moyne, professor of history at Yale University, on his most recent book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace, Reinvented War. Be right back after this. Folks, a couple of sponsors for our program today. Emma missed it, but I had bad food poisoning last week.
I heard about it this morning.
Oh, yeah. There was. I didn't give too much of the details, but it wasn't good. Mm. And the one thing that my doctor had said to me, he said, make sure you stay hydrated. Mm. And I was like, I got that. That's the one thing I got covered.
Liquid IV?
Liquid IV. One stick of liquid IV, 16 ounces of water, hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone. That's basically, liquid IV was basically my diet for 2 days because I couldn't eat anything. I was just like cramping up. I don't want to get too much into this. Liquid IV tastes great. They got flavors like watermelon, strawberry, lemon lime, your favorite, acai. Is it the way you say that?
Close enough.
There's a couple other flavors too that I've been really digging.
I like strawberry.
Strawberry, watermelon is a big one. Of course, I like the pina colada as well. I'm not gonna be ashamed of that. Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins, more vitamin C than an orange, and as much potassium as a banana. It's healthier than those sugary sports drinks. There are no artificial flavors. There's no artificial preservatives, and less sugar than an apple. Liquid IV is powered by cellular transport technology. An optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, potassium delivers water and nutrients into the bloodstream. The company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. Back in the days when I would travel, and hopefully again soon, I would take it for airline flights so I wouldn't dehydrate. When I feel cold coming on, I use the tangerine immunity support. When I need a little energy boost, which is very often, and giving up the coffee, I go for the matcha. That is a lemon, I think ginger technically, but it's for me, it's the matcha. They have passion fruit and guava. There's all sorts of flavors, and it's super easy. I could put a couple of packets in my bag, and bingo, bango, I'm set. You can grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MajorityRep. That's code MajorityRep at checkout. Not Majority Report, MajorityRep, just R-E-P. That's 25% off anything when you get better hydration today using the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Oh, and this is a great tool. I don't care what you do, whether you're writing for business or you just got to write emails to people or whatever it is. And I've been like pounding on Myla about this because she's now a junior. And I'm like, dude, there's two things that you need to know how to do better than anything else, reading and writing. And you're not going to, you know, the more you read, the better your writing becomes. But this is also a great tool to help develop, to both fix your writing in real time, but I also think it's a great tool to develop your writing skills. You want to write faster and better? Well, writing faster and better means you have better business, you have better relationships, you know, people you work with or colleagues. And this is why your team needs WordTune for Teams. WordTune, God bless you, is the only AI-powered writing tool that understands meaning, offering writing suggestions that help anyone achieve clear and compelling writing. It is the ultimate writing tool to elevate your team's writing instantly. This is the thing. When I approached this, you know, I tried out this WordTune, and I thought, like, oh, I've done, like, grammar stuff like this, and it's not that. It actually is a tool that enhances your style of writing. And it's pretty amazing where artificial intelligence is at this point. It really has the ability to tease out what you're trying to say and have you say it in a clearer fashion. And it also, it's just very helpful to see that type of correction. When can your team use WordTune? Well, WordTune improves performance on any project, everything from internal emails to press releases, sales outreach to customer service support, and so much more. You can use WordTune anywhere you're writing online, including Google Docs, Slack, Outlook, Web, WhatsApp, whatever. You can try WordTune for free at wordtune.com/majority. Check it out, folks. Are you looking to elevate your entire team's writing? Well, my listeners can get a discount for their team today at wordtune.com/majority. WordTune improves writing efficiency up to 4 times. Better, faster writing means better business. Start writing with WordTune at wordtune.com/majority. And lastly, I've talked about Honey many times before. We all shop online, even more so than we probably did 2 years ago. Folks also know that I don't like to spend a lot of money when I don't need to. My children have also learned this. For a long time, Myla started buying stuff online. I sat her down. I gave her the talk, which is you always search for promo codes before you buy anything. Now, fortunately for her, for Saul, when he comes of age, I won't have to give him that talk because we just put Honey in our browser. So manually searching for coupon codes, it's a thing of the past. Honey is a free browser extension. It scours the internet for promo codes. It applies the best one, finds it, and adds it to your cart. It supports over 30,000 stores online, ranging from sites that have tech and gaming products, popular fashion brands, even food delivery. So basically what happens is this. You're at your favorite site. Let's say in my instance, I'm buying a shirt. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm thinking of a particular site, but I don't know if they want me to mention that site. But I'm going in, I'm buying a shirt. You're about to check out. Honey pops down from your, just out of your browser, says, hold on, searching for coupons. Sometimes they land one, sometimes they don't. But the best part is, either way, you've got that peace of mind. Hey, I saved $5. Or hey, at least I didn't pass up the opportunity to save $5. Mm-hmm. And it happens almost instantaneously. It has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. If you use Amazon, it'll tell you like, hey, wait a second, there's a price drop, or there's been a price drop, or the price is up, and that's interesting. But I have saved money recently, like I say, on a shirt. There was something I bought for the office recently I saved a couple bucks on, and Myla saves money on her makeup. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free, installed in a few seconds. By getting it, you're doing yourself a solid and supporting this podcast. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com /majority. Okay, I want to welcome to the program Samuel Moyne. He is a professor of history at Yale University. His most recent book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Samuel, welcome to the program. I am joined by Emma Vigeland.
Thanks for having me.
So you start, in many respects, I mean, things start really moving after World War II. But let's just go back to where you start. You actually start with Leo Tolstoy, who makes a distinction about the way ones can wage war. And so this must have been in the air in the 1800s, this sort of notion that tame war. What was behind that? Talk about that sort of like idea at that time and why it was at that time.
So I start in the mid 19th century because that's when the Swiss come up with the bright idea of making war more humane. And they're responsible for the first Geneva Convention, the first in of the Geneva Conventions we still have on the books today. And Tolstoy basically worried that, you know, what if you make war so humane that you tolerate it? And I don't think he was right to ask that question at the time. He's right now because we've since Vietnam ended up making American war so much more humane than it was before that our presidents tell us it's okay to keep fighting endlessly because it is humane now.
What do we mean when we say humane, and has that term changed from the time that the Geneva Conventions were contemplated?
Sure. So back in the 19th century, the first Geneva Convention was just about the wounded on the battlefield and letting, you know, the Swiss and others take care of them when they were bleeding out. Since then, there are all kinds of other rules, especially involving POWs. But the ones I focus on are these new ones that come in the 1970s that say you can't shoot at a civilian. And if you shoot near a civilian, you can't kill too many civilians collaterally. And those are pretty novel. And they're ones that the United States tries to follow, or at least says it's following, in drone warfare and sending out special forces to, you know, 3/4 of the countries where they were last year. So at the beginning, back in the 19th century, you know, there were no rules saying you couldn't go to war. And so I think it was noble for the Swiss to say, let's at least make it kinder and gentler. Now, you and I will say humane war is an oxymoron. You can never have a humane war. But we have to register that these rules, when they're accepted by states like the United States, make war more humane than it was. If we compare the war on terror, not just in terms of Americans dying, but in terms of other victims to Vietnam or Korea or World War II, it's much more sanitized, and especially the new form of the war on terror with drones and special forces that will continue to fight.
Well, you say sanitized. I think that's the right word for it, right? I mean, what is the distinction between perceived humanity and sanitization? Because I think it can create a false sense that we've progressed.
Right. So it's here that I think, you know, I'm following Tolstoy because he worried about two different groups of people. First, the humanitarians. And he said, think back to slavery, since there were a lot of humanitarians before there were abolitionists who said, let's make it kinder and gentler. And Tolstoy said, that's not good enough. Maybe it was even a mistake if it entrenched slavery, which some historians actually think it did. Mm-hmm. So the one question is about humanitarians to think about the risk that you're entrenching war in struggling to make it nicer. And then there's us. Tolstoy compared the audience to people who demand that their meat be slaughtered humanely, but keep on eating it. And the worry there is that is what we would call bad faith. We think we're good people. because we're the kind of people who fight wars humanely. And Barack Obama invited us to think of ourselves that way. And his main speeches on the war, the Nobel Peace Prize address, and his speech 4 years later around drone warfare and targeted killings, he says, I have to fight war eternally. We're America. And the terrorists are always present. However, I am promising to do it in ways that should morally satisfy you. And a lot of people accepted it. And that's why we're still at war today.
I want to definitely, obviously, come back to that. But what was the impetus for Geneva, for Switzerland to do this? And because I want to sort of track that through right. the ages, right? Because should we take this at face value, right? Like, you know, and I think it seems to me at different points in history, as different sort of people deploy the desire for humane war, it's deployed for different reasons.
Of course. So I think in the beginning, you know, you have some Swiss gentlemen who are engaging in philanthropy, you know, noblesse oblige. They're well off and wealthy, and they're looking to burnish their own moral credentials. You have to note that this is also a fight about how to interpret Christianity at the time. You know, do we turn the other cheek, as Tolstoy said, Jesus insisted, or do we think that like making a modest difference through good works will save our souls? Today, I think humane war plays a lot of different roles. I think it's an essential thing for people to pursue. I'm not against it. What I'm worried about is when it has this nefarious consequence of legitimating war, and politicians know it does. Now, it can also play the role of just rationalization. We say it's humane, and it's not. You know, how can war ever be humane? But the truth is, the military since Vietnam has tried to take these roles seriously, and it's affected the fighting. And politicians have imposed rules on things like drone warfare. So it's not pure rationalization. It's somehow something that changes war while also creating more legitimacy for this new kind of war.
Maybe I'm skeptical or cynical, but I can't help but think that some of those Swiss who developed this idea was also like, this is a great way for us to maintain neutrality and not get on the wrong side of anybody in a war, right? Like if we sort of like preemptively say it's our thing to be neutral, we're not blamed. Yeah. We, you know, we're not going to get invaded. We're also not going to have to raise a military. I can't help but think that it's been cynically deployed ever since.
I think there's a bit of cynicism in everything, and you're right that there's the Swiss governmental neutrality, and these are private citizens setting up the Red Cross as initially a kind of Swiss brand, and these two things did fit together. I think you're making a very savvy point. However, you know, the cause of humane war went global. Actually, the Swiss almost lost custodianship over the laws of war at the end of World War II, just because they'd just done such a horrendous job. But they clawed it back, and they're still in charge of it. But, you know, I would say we have to have a bigger explanation, because this thing has buy-in from so many people. Think about how much we talked about the Geneva Conventions as Americans in response to George W. Bush's shredding of their obligations. And think about how much we've been concerned about the civilian and collateral damage under the drones, you know, not so much challenging their practice. And that's why they keep, you know, dropping bombs. So I'm with you that there's tons of cynicism. And what interests me is that this is something that presents as morally uplifting. And I want to say, even if it is, what's the dark side? How is it perpetuating, or at least risking that perpetuation along with it?
Let's talk about what and really, I think you make the point that World War II is sort of the pivot point for a couple of concepts in terms of this, around things like, you know, the right to go to war, and so what was the sort of the, I guess, the canon prior to World War II, and then how did it change after World War II?
So, you know, for 50 years prior to World War II, you've got a lot of transatlantic war, not least the two world wars. And the pivotal thing about World War II is, through it, America says we'll guarantee the transatlantic peace. Now, the price is heavy because Americans have been, you know, engaged in brutal war, you know, for centuries by that point, notably on our own continent, even overseas in the Philippines, lots of Latin American interventions. But because of this World War II decision and the coming of the Cold War, Americans become committed to global war, brutal global war, for decades, indeed through our time. The difference, I think, is that the initial forms of that, especially in Asia, Japan with firebombing and nuking, Korea, I think the most brutal war of the 20th century on both sides, and then Vietnam, is one form of American war. But then something happens after Vietnam to bring about this new form. And if you want, we can talk about, like, what were the factors. But it really did matter that America pivoted to be global hegemon in the first place. The question is, how did it move within that, from the brutal period to the more humane period? Because it wasn't in World War II, and it wasn't for decades after.
Right. And just to be clear, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think people are aware that the U.S. sort of took that position of the hegemon following World War II. And so we go through two wars before we get to this sort of new iteration of what a humane war could be. Well, I'm just curious. I just want to, like, you know, because when I think about the bombing of Dresden, or when I think about the dropping of the atomic weapons, and then of course in the Korean War, I don't even think we call it a war, but 3.5 million Koreans died. And what was there just no? It was just like we're just on the Geneva Conventions, those parameters of you know. We can, you know, just about anything goes at this point, except for, you know, the very marginal stuff.
So, you know, through that period, there kind of were three reasons why there wasn't much to write home about with the laws of war, and why Tolstoy's concerns were, let's say, premature. First, the law of war, aside from that first Geneva Convention in the 1860s, wasn't that humane. It was really about letting states do grievous damage. Then there was the fact that the laws of war were really for, let's call it, white-on-white war. And yet most of the global violence was perpetrated by American and European armies out in the so-called periphery, against non-white peoples who were largely excluded from coverage. And then, even when there was a bit of humane content, like for POWs, after a while, it was basically ignored. A great example being Adolf Hitler's execution of millions of Soviet soldiers, POWs, in World War II. Doesn't mean it was never followed, but it just wasn't that impressive. And so what had to happen, first in these 1949 Geneva Conventions, which are still kind of the ones still on the books, and then mainly in the 1970s, when there was an update, you get finally more humane content, especially you can't shoot at civilians and you can't kill too many collaterally. It's a decolonized world in which, you know, the peoples who've been suffering the brunt of global violence for centuries want to lessen it. And then the Europeans aren't fighting that violence anymore and can, like the Swiss have for decades, pose as moralists. Finally, Americans are shamed after Vietnam. And even the military accepts that you can't do that again. And so it's like a perfect convergence of a lot of factors that lead to a big pivot.
Okay, so let's talk about the factors behind that pivot. What drives that? I mean, at one point there becomes also, I mean, I guess this maybe happens after World War II, but the U.S. is not fighting for peace, but it's fighting for ostensibly for freedom, I guess. And we don't get that conduct of war until essentially the other side of Vietnam, where, you know, we have an idea of like, hey, we have a bunch of war criminals. Like, I mean, right. I even have the concept of war criminals, or at least U.S. people, U.S. servicemen being capable of war crimes until then?
So hard to say. I mean, at the Nuremberg trials, our Supreme Court justice, who's leading our legal team, Robert Jackton, says we can't give the Nazis a poison chalice and not pretend that, you know, these are universal standards. But the truth is that, you know, Americans have never been tried for any alleged crimes they've committed. In Vietnam, actually, there were a lot of proposals to try to rerun Nuremberg. First from like philosophers and intellectuals like Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre, and then from a very famous ex-Nuremberg prosecutor teaching at Columbia Law named Telford Taylor, who wrote a bestseller called Nuremberg in Vietnam. All those folks, though, remembered that Nuremberg had mainly indicted the Nazis for starting illegal wars. And after My Lai, we began to drop that concern. And we began to say, okay, America may need to continue to fight wars and go to war, and it may be very controversial when it does so. But what if it could fight more humanely and not commit the kind of war crimes that My Lai involved? And as I mentioned, for some in the military, and especially the lawyers, it was really important to get involved in the laws of war and use them to provide more legitimacy for American fighting. They were ashamed of what had happened, and they understood that the American military became unpopular. And so they thought the laws of war, which were newly humane in content, could be essential to like the moral credibility of the American military. So that mattered a huge amount.
We should say a lot of young people who watch the show My Lai massacre, you know, basically was the killing of up to, I think, 500 Vietnamese villagers, largely women and children. And that's only the most, I think, well known.
That's right.
I mean, there's a reason to believe that that was not there was many other massacres like that, I guess I should say.
Absolutely. Lots of debate about that, but I know we can say that even if it wasn't absolutely characteristic, it also wasn't a one-off. And yet this is the thing that I think we should think about when we raise an episode like that. First, it's true that people cared about it, unlike atrocities like Nogunri during, you know, Korea. People celebrated the incineration of Japanese civilians and did for decades. What happened after Abu Ghraib? You know, very similar set of revelations. The same reporter was involved, not just in My Lai, but in the Abu Ghraib revelations, namely Seymour Hersh. But a big difference in the aftermath. With a pre-existing anti-war movement, My Lai was fuel on the fire and played a role in making the war illegitimate. What happened after Abu Ghraib? It led to the removal of torture and other detainee abuse from the equation, like debugging the program of endless war, which continues. So I want to remember the My Lai events, but in a sense, observe how different they were, because the concern about atrocity was part of a larger concern about fighting war. And of course, we've lost it.
The one through line is Colin Powell involved in hiding both events, pretty much, right? Colin Powell was involved in the My Lai massacre, is my recollection.
Colin Powell was definitely kind of someone who wanted to learn a lot from the whole Vietnam experience in a lot of ways. And I think he's kind of a tragic figure, not, you know, only because he, I think, has acknowledged that he was made a tool in telling the United Nations that Saddam Hussein had WMD, but I'm thinking of two other things. First, he came up with something called the Powell Doctrine before 9/11, which was supposed to keep the military from engaging in wars it couldn't win and quagmires from which it couldn't escape. But what happened? Right. That's exactly what happened. But he also was part of the officer corps that wanted to make sure that the military was high-minded. And he says things as a result of the Gulf War, where you have military lawyers picking targets. You know, never go to war without your lawyers. Total novelty in American history. And so the part of Powell's agenda that survives is not the concern about quagmire. It's the concern to keep American war moral in its fighting through its compliance with these laws. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are.
That there's quotes around that word moral when you say that. I just want to make that clear. And also, I want to sort of just make that distinction that you were making between My Lai and torture. I want to make that really sort of clear. So in the instance of My Lai, it is a pathogen, if you want, or a it is that taints the entire war. Whereas in terms of Abu Ghraib, you're saying it's a pathogen that needs to be removed so that the war remains untainted, right? I mean, that, yeah. And in fact, that's what happened. And that's the distinction that that really we cross that divide as we go into the 70s. We are looking and we are looking as a way to sort of like make our wars a little bit more pure in some way without the sort of tainty things that make it seem bad.
I think that's right. And again, there's enormous political pressure, especially among liberals, to do so, because they've had a peace candidate, George McGovern, but he crashed. And sadly, I think the Democrats take from this harrowing experience the lesson that you can't be anti-war. And indeed, many of them claim to find progressive uses for American force through the world. So we get the rise of humanitarian intervention on the left and democracy promotion on the neocon right, which are both about licensing force in a big way after the end of the Cold War. I want to come back, though, because I want to make sure that, like, to me, this is something that seems moral to those who deploy it. And I would even say that those who stigmatize Abu Ghraib were doing the right thing. And I think they may have thought that they were actually going to delegitimize the war on terror, just as the commotion around My Lai had delegitimized Vietnam, but it didn't happen. And so what I want to say is there's this enormous risk that if you either just focus on the conduct of war, or you try to delegitimize the war by focusing on the conduct, you may end up entrenching what you hate and leave war on a kind of more stable foundation than if you found it.
So why did that happen? I mean, if your thesis is correct, that in some ways by focusing on the torture as something like this is, I mean, this is what we said at the time, like, this is not the America I know or whatever. And it's like saying, but the America I know also does wage war. In fact, I think you made the point that, like, from after World War II, we had something like 300 interventions, military interventions, and 80% of those happened after 89, I think it was.
Right.
And so it's like the torture, that's not the America that's not the America that we all believe in. The America we all believe in, though, does go to war. And right. So, but what is that? You say, like, that's what happened. Like, what is that passive force? Or was that a passive force?
Well, I don't think so.
Okay, yeah, explain
so
to us.
I think because there's an actor and his name is Barack Obama, and he's, you know, he's totally with your description, because, you know, he didn't bring the torturers to justice, but he did acknowledge that something went wrong, and he constantly said torture is not us. But the implication is that endless war is us, if it could be made torture free. Now, how that happened, I think, you know, requires us to look with a critical eye at this crucial period after spring 2004 and the Abu Ghraib revelations. I think it made sense for many of us to say, look, you can't spit in the wind of the war on terror. You can't oppose it. All you can do is oppose the evils in it and maybe undermine it for a future in which it can be closed down. But here's the problem. Obama capitalizes on that activism. And when he comes onto office, the first day he shreds the torture memos, even though torture hasn't been practiced for years by that point. And he promises to fight the war humanely in these two major speeches I mentioned. So it's kind of giving him a gift, and he opened it. And, you know, if it's a Pandora's box that we're living with, that's another matter. But, you know, the fact is he's the one who did have an opportunity to take a much more hostile stance towards the war on terror. He had a lot of other opportunities with regard to the economy as well, we know, and he didn't take them. And instead, he became a figure of continuity, a knot of change you can believe in.
And we should say, you know, you quoted Colin Powell, you know, bring the lawyers. That's exactly what Obama did. And he codified all of these things. I mean, Charlie Savage wrote a great book about this. He took what was sort of outside the bounds of our legal system, figured a way to write the, you know, to get legal opinions and fit it within a legal system. And then it almost like the, once it becomes legal, right, it almost becomes a euphemism for, or a vernacular for humane. Because right. It's not illegal. I mean, so we are doing it according to the rules. And this all gets, and it's that, it seems to me, and it's also his failure to hold people to account from the other administration, whether it was a context of sort of a impeachment or to have trials. And then also Haspel and Brennan and all these people, it wasn't just a matter of like, I'm not even going to hold you to account. It's like, it's not going to really interfere with your trajectory of your career.
Right. So he retained the essentials of the war on terror as it had already, in a sense, been stabilized in the later Bush years. He didn't need to call a lawyer. He was one, but he definitely took steps that Bush never did to formalize kind of endless war. You know, what I would say is he, because there was no anti-war movement, or he actually, you know, to the extent there was, he took the air out of that balloon. You know, in the early years, people really did think he was a peace candidate, witness the Nobel Prize. He didn't have to face pushback when he took American force illegally to new places, or, you know, went beyond the mandates of the United Nations resolution in the case of the destruction of Libya. But he was intensely concerned with getting his lawyers to present, you know, the way Americans are going to fight this war as in conformity with standards, or even go beyond the standards that require you to fight humanely. So I mentioned that the 1970s rule, which is still on the books, is that you can't strike in war if you think that the collateral damage will outweigh the advantage you gain. Obama went way further and said in a drone strike or other targeted killing, if there's any risk of collateral damage at all, we won't strike. Now, it's not that that rule was followed, because it wasn't. Too many died for it to be followed. But the fact that he said it, he was going to follow this rule, is really revealing, because he understood that he was going to play on the humanity in order to extend and expand the war. And so I think, the law and the law of humane war has a really important place in the outcome. And that's why I wrote the book.
How much does technology also sort of add to this? Because technology and I guess sort of the development, the you know, some of the lessons that were learned from Vietnam. So I'm thinking about Bush not allowing any photographs of any returning military personnel who have been killed. The embedding of reporters in Iraq, so it made it almost like impossible for reporters to get independent stories or other perspectives other than with U.S. military personnel. I mean, I did this during the Iraq War, and it was amazing to walk around in the mid 2000s. And nobody seemed to sort of even acknowledge the fact that we were at war. I mean, after 2006 and the Democrats come in to Congress, nobody just wasn't, you know, whatever, like not aware of millions of internal refugees or hundreds of thousands of people we're killing. It's just going on. And it's like it's over there. Just so happens that one of the players of the United States, but it's not really any of our business. I mean, that to me seems like sort of, I guess, the 1-2, I'm not sure which part of that, of the humane right. thing, right? Like the humane part is the jab, and the sort of complete submersion of awareness of the thing going on is the hook, right. I guess.
I think that's right. And I think it, you know, goes back to Tolstoy's analogy with humane slaughter of non-human animals. You know, we have laws that require them to be slaughtered humanely, but we also have that killing far away and out of sight, even so. So these two things, distance and humanity, work together to kind of salve the conscience or keep sight out of mind for so many people. You know, there's also a technological component to the kind of rise of this light or no footprint war with teched up special forces or, you know, armed drones or standoff missiles, as opposed to like, you know, like inevitably violent, you know, close hands, big, big, heavy footprint, lots of troops in invasions and occupations. And there, you know, my reflection is that we seek the technology that we morally want. You know, we're not looking for napalm anymore, even though that served Americans, you know, for various ends, precisely because it was brutal. Now we are commissioning from, you know, Raytheon et al. Drones, which serve not just a strategic end, but also this kind of you know, end of securing the moral acceptability for enough people of the continuous engagements.
This is the this was also the sort of the vision that I guess like a guy like Rumsfeld had too of the military, right? We're just gonna
absolutely,
you know, like JSOC. We're gonna have such a light footprint with, and you know, guys in I don't know, Chevy Chase, Maryland are gonna be fighting our war in Pakistan.
Right.
With just a remote control drone.
Yeah. And now, you know, drones are old fashioned and we're on the verge of autonomous weapon systems, which don't require, you know, men with joysticks or pilots somewhere else. Absolutely. You know, the revolution in military affairs, so-called, you know, had to be put aside for the invasions in Afghanistan and Iraq that Don Rumsfeld actually, went to his grave, you know, having sponsored. That's kind of, I think, the most famous thing that he's done. However, it was really due to the crisis of both of those invasions and occupations that, in a way, the new light or no footprint form of war that Rumsfeld had always advocated kind of was born. And I think the humanity affected that latter form of war, especially because Obama applied these rules to theaters that weren't Afghanistan and Iraq, or later ISIS, but places where he just wanted to, you know, send a drone or special forces. And that became like an alarmingly big area, a long list of places. And it even got worse under Trump, although Trump retained the essentials of Obama's humane rules in whatever his personal preferences.
He loosened some of the those rules
on transparency, but this crucial rule that you can't strike if you think anyone will die collaterally, he kept amazingly.
Wait, didn't he loosen that? I thought my understanding is he loosened that in the context of, I think, of Afghanistan.
So it didn't apply in Afghanistan to begin with. It only applied in so-called areas outside active hostilities. And so we're talking about, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, sub-Saharan Africa generally, where there's a huge drone infrastructure built under Obama.
So what happens when we do get those autonomous weapons? Like when it's not even like... I mean, that's super humane, right? Like, I mean, humans aren't even doing this. It's just a robot that we happen to program and deploy. And that's just like, you know, it's like, it's almost like a stoplight. It's just, you know, it's just, it's really stopping. How do we break through to the discussion about the legitimacy of war, period, rather than the legitimacy of the way that we're waging war when we are faced with this type of automation of everything?
I think that's the current dilemma, and we're seeing both possibilities in this domain. So, you know, the lawyers are already haggling about what it would take to make these machines humane. And again, can you imagine them being like police forces, in the sense that, you know, someday, you know, with the right algorithms, they will have to ask if you want to surrender first before they shoot, or do they capture in preference to killing out wherever. But then there's something else that's promising, which is this, you know, Stop the Killer Robots campaign. And actually that's been sponsored by one of those human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, that for decades basically said, we don't pronounce on whether wars are good or bad. We just say whether you're fighting them humanely or inhumanely. Well, you know, if you take a weapon, a particular kind of weapon, in this case, a slaughter bot, and say, we condemn it. Well, I think that's coming close to condemning the wars of the future. And to me, it's a really promising thing that there's new activism that's not just about humanity, but about whether we can accept this extraordinarily disturbing form of war that's, you know, coming down the pike, even if the programming is good.
Is the critique of, how is the critique of war, and I guess particularly from the United States, as waged by the United States, and the critique of imperialism, is that distinct? Or is it essentially at this point, like, people's either awareness of the issue of imperialism is like sliding into their awareness of war, or is it coming from the other direction?
I think it depends on how you define your term. So, you know, whatever kind of empire America is, it's one that is not like the old empires that engaged in conquest. It does definitely engage in war. And to me, the disturbing novelty about American empire is that it's taking its wars and making them more like policing, you know, already making them humane even before you get the good programmed autonomous weapons systems, and saying it would be nice if we could follow these humane rules. And, you know, so to me, we're seeing something that is a new form of war and therefore a new form of empire. But there are, of course, other forms of empire, notably like in economic relations. However, I would just, you know, stress that the evolution my book is trying to highlight in the way we've fought war and said war can become moral is like a new face of empire that old empires didn't present, because brutality was fine. Now it's less and less so, but it doesn't mean that empire is over. Indeed, it could become more insidious if it's humane but eternal.
Samuel Moyne, the book is Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, quick break, and then we will be back to wrap things up for our Peacock viewers. Just a reminder, folks, if you're in California, tomorrow is the last opportunity, right? Is it tomorrow? I thought it was the 13th, but today's the 13th, but it should be on a Tuesday. So it's tomorrow is your final opportunity to vote in the recall of Gavin Newsom. The I'm not necessarily a huge Gavin Newsom fan, to be honest with you, but if you vote to recall him, then it's an open, essentially, race to who could become your next governor. I still remember the last recall, and Gary Coleman would have been an upgrade on the Schwarzenegger that ended up winning. But here is Steve Ducey on Fox and Friends and Brian Kilmeade and Rachel Campos Duffy with the guy who's most likely to win in the event that the recall passes. So you're going to want to vote a no on the recall.
That's the number one thing you've got to do.
Here is Larry Elder on Fox and Friends.
Lived in California, the degradation of that state under his leadership is really quite apparent. You know, Larry, I'm really curious about, I know you've been working hard, and it looks like, you know, the fact that they're bringing in these big names, they are threatened by you and your candidacy. I'm worried about fraud. You know, when they found that meth addict with 300 ballots in his the trunk of his car, are you hearing any other stories like that? And how worried are you that that might be part of this election?
I am worried about fraud, and we have a...
Yeah, the meth addict in who's got 300 ballots. Now, of course, the meth addict with the 300 ballots didn't actually vote that many times, and I don't even know if the ballots were actually legit.
How do you know that? Could have been working on behalf of Newsom.
But it really is amazing. It's almost as if, like, the only reason why they want this the elections now are to claim fraud.
Fraud, yeah.
There it is.
Well, that's going to happen more and more frequently.
And of course, why waste all those trips by those Democratic luminaries when you got this thing in the bag because of the fraud, all the meth addicts you got going around with all their ballots? It seems like
a
little redundant.
Shouldn't be worried if they've already had this handled.
Folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, we say goodbye and see you tomorrow. Goodbye and see you tomorrow. For those of you who are still here, hello and see you today. We got a lot of stuff planned for the fun half today. Of course, it's Monday, which means that Emma's down in the dumps because the Giants didn't win. And
well, I mean, this is
whole
what...
show's trajectory now is going to be a function of Emma's.
It's like my uncle after a Vikings game.
Malaise.
Well, I feel for him with the Vikings. This is supposed to be their year because they have one down year in the even number years, and then the odd number years they're back and good again, but not good enough to actually make any noise. Sad though, they lost to the Bengals in overtime. But I will say, I'm not used to it by now, but the Giants haven't won a playoff game since the Super Bowl 10 years ago. Did you know that?
I don't remember that Super Bowl.
I do like that they brought the old Giants helmets back as opposed to the throwback NY ones, because now these new Giants ones are like throwback too. And
they
aesthetically
didn't.
I like them.
But like they'll do it for Thursday because I think it's the Thursday night. Yeah, it sucks. Like, I mean, this year I actually have expectations, so I was more sad than normal. You know, like Daniel Jones' rookie year, you just want them to look competent. It's his third year. Still shaky on that front. So,
hey, Emma, look on the bright side. You're not a Jets fan.
Yep. There's always that, Bradley.
Like me.
There's always that.
Well, folks, there it is. I hope that was get a little taste of that. And but we've got we're going to talk more about Joe Manchin, we got George W. Bush trying to, and Rudy Giuliani. There are 9/11, Sarah, you know, things.
You don't
want
to talk about how I hit on some bets yesterday, though?
No, I don't. I really don't.
Steelers plus 6.5. Cardinals.
Oh, my God. All right, folks. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help this show thrive and survive, you also get extra content. So become a member today. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is our members that keep this show going. Don't forget, you can also sign up for our AM Quickie newsletter. Head over to majority.fm, scroll down to the bottom of the page, just put your email in. We'll never sell it to anybody, but we will send you some headline news every morning, and people are loving it, so you should check it out. That is the AM Quickie. Also, don't forget, we have our Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Matt, what is happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
This weekend we released for patrons an episode I'm really excited about with Charles Keeney. He's the author of The Road to Blair Mountain on the Battle of Blair Mountain, which was the largest labor uprising in this country's history, and also the second time in America where American citizens dropped bombs from planes onto other Americans, this happening 90 days after the Tulsa Massacre. So we talk about this, if you want to access that. We'll probably release it for everybody in a week or two, but patreon.com/leftreckoning to hear that, and how you can find your own local Blair Mountain and use it as a rallying point for activism.
I mean, Second Amendment says it's okay to drop bombs on people, right? I mean, everybody has the right to
bear arms and use
bear
them,
arms
I guess.
And use them.
Yeah, well-regulated air militia.
Yeah, why not?
Every time you talk about that, I think of Escape from Witch Mountain, that movie, but that's not.
That's not the same.
Just getting back in the groove. Jeez.
Don't forget, check out Nomi Show, youtube.com/TheNomiKey Show. Also on Twitch, twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. Why'd you look at me like that?
I'm not. I'm waiting for you to wrap things up.
See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. You went like this. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman.
I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You. Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.